Hi, this is Meg Malone, the Vermont Edition digital producer, and you're listening to the Vermont Edition podcast. This episode has been edited for clarity and brevity. Happy listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this year, the state legislature passed a law reducing cash bail for low-level offenders. The law went into effect last month and caps the maximum bail at $200 for people charged with certain misdemeanors. Now, many of them don't have bail imposed on them anyway, but advocates say this is one step in reforming a system that results in people who are poor staying in jail while they await trial, while those with more means are able to stay out. Bernie Sanders has introduced federal legislation that would eliminate cash bail altogether, but that seems unlikely to make much progress under current political conditions. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to get updates on what's happening in Vermont's criminal justice system, concentrating specifically on our corrections department. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Corrections Commissioner Lisa Menard. But first, we wanted to get an update on what's been happening with the 200-plus people convicted of crimes in Vermont who are serving their sentences out of state, currently at Camp Hill in Pennsylvania. Taylor Dobbs is a reporter for 7 Days and formerly of VPR. He has spent a lot of time investigating the situation in Pennsylvania and, in particular, several Vermont inmates who died or became terminally ill at Camp Hill. I spoke with Dobbs yesterday, and he reminded us why some people are currently serving time out of state to begin with.
The state's prison system has a fixed capacity, obviously, and it has maybe enough capacity to take all of the total number of inmates that the state has, but the highest security or high and medium security capacity is smaller than that. And so these inmates that get sent out of state are those who have been convicted of some of the most serious crimes in the inmate population, so murder, rape, and similar violent crimes like that. And they've been sent out of state so that they can be in a facility that has an appropriate level of security. And there's about 200 and change, depending on timing. There's sort of constantly inmates going back and forth, but about 200 are out of state right now.
And that number has come down over the years.
That's come down substantially. It used to be above 500, and they've worked really hard to bring down the overall inmate population. And then whenever that happens, they try to make the reductions in the out-of-state population as soon as they can.
Over the years, prisoners have been sent to Arizona, Michigan, Indiana. Right now, Vermont's out-of-state prisoners are at a prison in Pennsylvania. But that contract is up, and the state is looking for a new contract now and potentially, probably, a completely different place. Why are they looking for a new contract now?
Well, it's not entirely clear why the relationship with Pennsylvania is dissolving. We know that there was a contract in place that had a provision where either side could end the contract with 6 months' notice. And earlier this year, that's exactly what the state of Pennsylvania did. They submitted their written notice to the state of Vermont that they no longer wish to house these inmates. And so that started a six-month timeline, which we're currently in, and the state is now trying to figure out whether to place those inmates at Central Falls Detention Facility in Rhode Island, where they have submitted a bid, or a Core Civic facility in Mississippi. Core Civic is the private prison contractor that used to be known as Corrections Corporation of America.
So why is it not clear then? It sounds like Pennsylvania terminated the contract, so where's the ambiguity?
Well, there have been a lot of problems with this contract since basically right at the beginning. When the Vermont inmates got to Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, just over a year ago, they had a lot of problems with personal property that they had owned in Michigan, things like tablets to communicate with the outside or TVs. Those things got sort of lost in the shuffle, and inmates lost a lot of money's worth of personal property there. Then there's also been some pretty serious allegations of abuse and mistreatment of inmates. Multiple inmates have died either in the Camp Hill facility or since returning to Vermont from there. And Vermont officials have said they have a lot of trouble getting answers out of Pennsylvania corrections officials when these things happen. The Defender General of Vermont is responsible for investigating any inmate death or allegations of abuse, and they say it's basically impossible to get Pennsylvania DOC to work with them and provide access to inmates and provide information about what's going on down there, and that makes it really hard to have accountability.
You've actually talked with inmates who are at Camp Hill who've been telling you from their perspective what they see as abuses that are inflicted upon them. Can you detail a few of them?
Yeah, the most severe and detailed abuses that I've been told about came from, we got corroborated reports from 7 different inmates who wrote in, and one of them called me. And that was in a case where there was a verbal dispute in the cafeteria over a chicken patty. Either the inmate was not served a patty or didn't like the patty, and a guard stepped in and started arguing with the inmate, and they had a argument sort of walking back to the cell block together. And then when they got there, what I was told is that the guard ordered the inmate to go into a sort of a hallway off to the side that is outside of camera range, and then got another guard to sort of block the door while the first guard then repeatedly hit the inmate, punched him in the face until he fell on the ground, and then kept hitting him, bashed his head against the wall. There was a lot of blood. So that is, you know, a very serious allegation of abuse. There was an investigation into that. But as I said, Pennsylvania officials are very tight-lipped. When I did a story about that incident, they refused to even confirm the identity of the officer. So that's the kind of sort of wall of silence that both press and state officials are dealing with Pennsylvania.
And when you talk about deaths that have occurred at Camp Hill or with inmates who have just recently been returned to Vermont, we're talking about inmates not receiving proper medical treatment.
Right. There was one case last October, specifically an inmate named Roger Brown died, and his death certificate said that he died of metastatic cancer. And in the weeks before his death, he kept a diary in his cell. And that was sent to me when I was reporting for VPR. And it showed that he was being treated essentially with gel insoles and ibuprofen as this cancer spread throughout his body and ultimately killed him. Camp Hill officials say they have no chemotherapy ability at that facility. He died at that facility. There's no evidence he ever left to receive cancer treatment. So it seems as though this inmate wasted away and died of cancer in plain view of Pennsylvania officials, and they were giving him ibuprofen for the pain. And so that's obviously not the standard of care that I think people expect of the correction system. And I know multiple inmates are heavily urging Commissioner Menard to bring them home or to at least intervene and you know, do more to make sure that the Vermont inmates that are being housed out of state, if the state is going to go that direction, these inmates are saying they really need to do a better job looking out for Vermont inmates. And some say that the state of Vermont should be sending a dedicated full-time staff member to work at those out-of-state facilities so that the inmates have a point of contact.
We will be talking live with Commissioner Lisa Menard following our interview with you, and we'll put those questions to her. But what have you heard from Vermont DOC in terms of their responsibility to these inmates?
They say they take it very seriously. They do send staff down to Pennsylvania on a very regular basis. They have dedicated staff whose essentially their sole responsibility is to manage these relationships between Vermont DOC and the out-of-state contractors. So they are dedicating resources to overseeing this. The question that inmates have is it enough? And there's another issue that has to do with the type of relationship that the state has with this contractor. Right now, they're going through an interstate compact. It's legally complicated, but essentially it just means that the Vermont inmates in Pennsylvania have to live under the policies of the state of Pennsylvania. When those don't match with Vermont, essentially the answer is, well, that's too bad, you're in Pennsylvania. And those inmates really don't like that, especially when it comes to solitary confinement. They're being put in solitary confinement for 30-plus days, which is actually illegal in Vermont. And Vermont officials have had to figure out how to deal with that, and they've actually started bringing folks home if they get 30-plus days of assigned solitary confinement down in Pennsylvania.
That's Taylor Dobbs, a reporter for 7 Days. Taylor, thanks for updating us on what you know about the situation in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania.
Good to be on.
And let's turn now to Vermont Corrections Commissioner Lisa Menard to talk about some of the issues with Camp Hill and where things stand with moving people who are incarcerated out of state again. Commissioner Menard, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, no problem.
So this was supposed to be a three-year contract, right, with Pennsylvania, 2 or 3 years?
A three-year compact agreement.
Compact agreement. Okay, right. Not a contract. But it was terminated as you were listening to Taylor Dobbs there. I saw you scowling at the question of who terminated and why. Do you want to clarify?
I do. It was accurate. Pennsylvania terminated. However, the termination is not what drove the desire to move or the posting of the request for proposal. We had been putting that together, and Pennsylvania was aware of that.
So they basically terminated the compact because they knew that Vermont wanted out.
Or that we were posting it to take other bids.
Okay. And why were you doing that?
We were doing that for a number of reasons, many of which Taylor just spoke about. The compact has been very difficult, not specific to the state of Pennsylvania, but I think any arrangement like this that was under the compact would be very difficult because you can't have the same rights and entitlements as you do as a Vermont inmate under the compact. You have the same rights and entitlements as the inmates in that state. Some of the things that were most problematic initially were, I think, something you and I have spoken about before, which was the tablets. It sounds small, but when you're incarcerated, that's a big deal. And we weren't able to have them keep their tablets as they had had in the last facility in Michigan and that they would have in Vermont. Things like more direct access to prisoners' rights, phones in Vermont in the units, they're able to connect with them, and prisoners' rights can come into our facilities at any time and walk through the units and talk to inmates. Things like that really make a compact agreement very difficult.
But surely you knew all of that when you signed it.
I don't know. To be very candid, I'm not sure I did fully understand that level of minutia of things that wouldn't be provided because they're things that had just always been in place. And when you very quickly have to move 200, and I think at that time it was 270 inmates, our previous contract in GEO did end fairly abruptly. They gave us notice because we were so few inmates in such a large facility. So we were really in a time crunch to move a lot of inmates to the best possible placement that we could. And we were obviously looking at life safety, security issues, housing for them, and the minutiae didn't probably get worked out as well as it could have.
Okay, so now the people who are currently serving time at Camp Hill are definitely moving, and you're in the process of figuring out where they will move to and what a new contract or compact would look like. And is it by October that has to go into effect?
That's correct. Pennsylvania gave us notice in April, which the 6 months notice will come into effect in October.
So where are you in the process now of figuring out the next step?
We had posted a request for proposal. We received two bids. Both of those bids have been evaluated, and we are in negotiations with the bidder that prevailed in that process. So we're currently in negotiations to finalize a contract.
And can you tell me which of the two bidders you're looking at? Because as we talked about with Taylor, it's Central Falls Detention Facility Corporation, which runs the Donald W. Wyatt Detention Facility in Rhode Island, and then CoreCivic runs the Tallahatchie County Correctional Facility in Mississippi. And those were the two potential choices, right?
That's correct. And I can't tell you which one it is because it's still in the process of negotiations. I will tell you, I mean, as obviously you know, they are both for-profit systems, so it will not be a compact agreement again. It'll be a contract agreement. And can I loop back to something else Taylor said very briefly? And it's a minor point of clarification, but I think it may be important. He mentioned that we didn't have – the reason we had people out of state is because we didn't have enough medium and high security beds and that the people out of state needed those beds. I might frame that a little bit differently, only in that I don't want the assumption to be because somebody is convicted of a high-level offense, such as murder, it doesn't automatically mean that they need to be placed in a closed custody, high security. They could be, you know, low security for a number of reasons. we don't have enough general population beds. That means beds that anyone can be in that is not segregated or is not in a work camp. That's what we lack.
When you and I have talked about this before, I thought part of the issue, though, was that at a certain point, no matter how many people you are able to bring back into the state of Vermont, there will always be, at least in the current facilities and setup that we have, there will always be some people who need to serve a sentence out of state because of the security level.
That's accurate. Okay. There will be, but it is not 200.
Okay. And okay. So how many do you think it would be?
You know, I don't know. I would say possibly 40 people. And it's not always just because of the higher security level. There are other issues such as, you know, co-defendants. Perhaps someone is a family member of a victim of another inmate.
And they can't be in the same area.
Exactly. And Vermont is small.
So when these people are eventually taken out of Camp Hill and they go to the new prison, whether it's in Rhode Island or Mississippi, how are they going to be transported? Does Vermont do that, or would Pennsylvania do that, or would the new facility do that?
I believe under this circumstance, I'd have to go back and look at the agreement with Pennsylvania. They may have – it may be in the agreement that they move them to the next site, and it may be the new vendor that does it. It'll be one or the other.
Taylor Dobbs and I were talking yesterday when we interviewed him, and he said that some prisoners at Camp Hill have told him that they're really worried that if it is Pennsylvania that moves them, that they will be sort of subjected to one last retaliatory act of mistreatment in the transport, because that's the last chance as they leave. Is there any way that you can sort of figure that out before they move?
Oh, we will absolutely know who's moving them before they move. And it is also likely that we would have Vermont staff involved in that transport as well. As we get closer to the date of the move, we will have Vermont staff on site in Pennsylvania almost constantly, not necessarily based on the retaliation concerns, although that's important to address that inmates may feel that way, but also to make sure that they have all the information they need for the move.
You know, one of the questions that comes up is if the state of Vermont, the royal we, has been unhappy with this compact and has either witnessed or believes inmates who say they've been mistreated or that this is not the treatment that Vermont wants to have people who are incarcerated be subjected to, is there any action that can be taken, or is it just like, oh, well, you know, that's too bad, we'll change the contract, but sorry for what you went through for that year and a half?
You know, whether there's any action or not, offenders certainly have the ability to litigate at any time, which they do frequently. And I will say, I'm not to minimize anyone's concerns or complaints, but we are not always at liberty to say the entirety of a story or an event that has occurred.
So what about people who say, I lost money because I had, you know, money on my tablets. Mm-hmm. I've lost my personal property when it is the tablet. In the new move, is there a sense that that will be addressed so that people won't again sort of be subjected to losing money and property?
That is certainly one of the goals. First of all, part of losing property is not necessarily being clear or having things change on what property you can bring. Clearly, the goal this time is to be very clear and very sure about what you can bring and to make sure that it makes it with them in that trip.
Chris in Middlebury sent us a note saying, it seems cruel to me that so many Vermont prisoners are sent to distant states where their families can't visit them. If we can't house them here, aren't their prisons at least closer? And he says he mentions some other states like Tennessee or Michigan. And again, out-of-state prisoners are currently in Pennsylvania, but we're looking at Rhode Island and then Mississippi. So what about Chris's concern that, you know, they can't get visitors from home? Mm-hmm. It's very far away if they're in some place like Mississippi.
Anywhere outside of Vermont, and sometimes even within Vermont, it's very difficult for families to visit. With the tablets, it did give inmates an opportunity to have visits, so I think that that will help. And I certainly don't disagree. I personally, and most of the people I work with and most of the people I talk to, would much rather have the inmates in the state of Vermont. We simply do not have enough beds in the state of Vermont. Closer would be better. We're not receiving bids necessarily for closer. We did get one, which has been evaluated. And again, looking at if another correction system, a not-for-profit but a state system, were to bid, we would be talking about a compact again. And the reality is, if we're talking about 206 inmates, they're going to take up a part of a unit in some of these larger facilities. And that state system can't change all of their rules, and they're operating for one small component that would not help their systems at all. So I think that's part of the problem in attracting bids. For us, it's a very large number, 206 inmates out of state. It's terrible, and it really is. But for other entities, 206 inmates is really not many.
VPR's Jonathan Butler sent us a note for this program, too, saying New York City recently made their inmates' phone calls from jail free. If you've ever had a loved one inside, it can be really hard to communicate. And some states impose fees where family and inmates are charged per call, per minute, or per email sent and received. This creates a burden, especially on poor inmates. What's Vermont's system, and how does this work with inmates in other states? How does the Department of Corrections ensure they're not unfairly taxing poor inmates and their families?
Those are good questions, and certainly things that we consider regular. We do have one of the lowest per inmate costs. Unfortunately, I can't give you that cost off the top of my head. We do have one of the lowest, but there clearly is one for making those calls. Every time that we renegotiate a contract, we try to make it lower and lower and lower, and we've done, I think, a very good job of that. It is not, however, free at this point. There are ways for inmates to make money by having jobs and facilities and to put that money on their account. Family members take up really most of the burden on that and send money in to put on the accounts.
And in other states, I mean, when we've been talking about this compact, is that people in Pennsylvania, are they subjected to the cost of the Pennsylvania system?
Correct.
And let's bring another voice into this conversation. Tom Dalton is the executive director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform. Tom, nice to talk with you. Hi, Tom.
Oh, hey, sorry.
So I'm glad you're with us, and I'm glad you're here to talk about some of the issues that your organization is focusing on. And, you know, depending on what's really top of mind and a top issue, you focus on different things at different times. And I understand that one of the things that you're really working on right now is looking at how a new law that was passed in Vermont this legislative session is being enacted in Vermont prisons. And, you know, earlier this year, the legislature passed a measure that basically allows inmates to either start or continue medication-assisted treatment for opioid addiction, something like buprenorphine, for an unlimited time in prison. Prior to the bill, they were capped at 120 days, which was actually an expansion. And now it's unlimited, and people can actually start medication-assisted therapy in prison. So what is it that you're concerned about or that you're watching on this topic?
So we're just keeping an eye on how implementation is rolling out. And, you know, I have to give the Department of Corrections credit for putting a lot of effort into this. I've been meeting with some people from central office, and I'm definitely convinced that a sincere and strong effort is being made from central office. But at the same time, I'm getting lots and lots of phone calls and letters from incarcerated Vermonters who are saying that on the ground, in the facilities, the progress is really slow and limited, and a lot of people who should be getting access to medication-assisted treatment under the law are not getting it.
Is that mainly people who would like to start this kind of treatment who are feeling like it's not being well implemented, or are people actually being taken off treatment before they think they should be?
So I'm not hearing that people are being taken off at 120 days anymore, so that's a significant improvement. But in terms of people who are coming into the facility now, what I'm hearing, what I've heard from the Department of Corrections, is about half of the people who were in withdrawal for opiates at the time they became incarcerated actually were given medication-assisted treatment. And my many years of experience in the community tell me that the number of people who would be asking for access is much higher than half. And so, you know, that's a concern. Also, people who had been taken off at 120 days or even before that, 30 days or 90 days as the policy changed, a lot of those people still haven't been put back on, or at least some of those people have not been put back on. And in terms of people who maybe never had the opportunity to begin treatment with drug treatment medications and maybe even are testing positive for heroin or other opiates in the facility and being penalized for that are not being offered the opportunity to be in treatment instead of getting punished. And then people that are, you know, getting out of the facility, one of the main goals of the law is to make sure that people are on medication-assisted treatment with drug treatment medications before they're released, because the research shows that people that are transitioning from incarceration are at, depending on the study, it could be, you know, 10 times the risk for fatal overdose during the weeks following release. And I'm still seeing people that are being released into the community without drug treatment medication, without coordination with community providers, which is also required by the law, and even without Narcan, which is required by a different law.
So let me put this to Commissioner Menard, and then we'll come back to you, Tom. So, you know, what about what Tom Dalton says he's hearing from inmates who say, I'm not getting the treatment, I'm not getting put on it, and not coming out with what they need?
Mm-hmm. We're about a month in, month and a half in, so I think it's premature to call this a failure at this point.
Which I don't think Tom is either.
I just want to make sure we're clear on that. We have made significant progress, and I very much appreciate Tom's acknowledgement of working with the central office staff. I know he has spent a lot of time speaking with our director of mental health and addiction services. We all have the same goal. What we are doing now is, as people come in, obviously we're not taking people off at 120 days anymore unless there's a specific medical concern. As people come in, they're being screened. What we're finding, and it's one of those unfortunate kind of scenarios, many people who are coming in detained simply aren't with us long enough. That a determination may be made that, yes, they should be inducted on this, and that may, in fact, even begin, or it may be authorized to begin, and then they're released. They go to court. The court releases them, and I don't think we want to view that as a bad thing. It's unfortunate we weren't able to get them on the medication in time. But I think for the court process to hold people in to have it would be worse. As far as inducting people prior to release, I do think that's the area that we certainly need to be very mindful of. You know, the goal there is harm reduction, because as Tom says, studies do show that people returning from incarceration are more likely to experience an overdose. So we're trying to avoid that, and certainly we're making effort to do that. So we're working on continuation, induction upon coming into a facility, induction upon some point of release, some point prior to release, and putting people back on who may have been taken off. So all these things are in play, and it is certainly possible that somebody was not put on that maybe could have been. I don't know the specific case, but you know, please do let us know, and we'll look into all of them.
Why couldn't all people who are released from prison, or all who say they might want it, get Narcan? I mean, citizens can get Narcan.
Narcan, they absolutely should. I was talking about the actual buprenorphine. To get Narcan,
right,
Everyone should be offered. It's our policy. Everyone who's leaving should be offered Narcan, whether or not you have an opioid use disorder. We have found anecdotally that some people opt not to take it. I don't know if that's the case. Obviously, it's probably not. In the case Tom references, it should be offered
to everybody.
Okay, absolutely.
Tom Dalton, I know we have you for a limited time, so I want to ask you about another thing as well. A project that you're working on with the Chittenden County State's Attorney on something called For the Sake of the Children. And you can describe this, but this is trying to sort of create an alternative to incarceration for mothers who have young children.
So, right, it's trying to help raise awareness about the fact that there is, you know, disastrous harm to children caused by the incarceration of a parent. And there's research around something called an adverse childhood experience. And the research shows that children with an incarcerated parent have 5 times more adverse childhood experiences than their peers without an incarcerated parent. And the reason that's important is because the research shows that the more adverse childhood experiences or traumas that a child experiences, the worse their health outcomes and a whole range of outcomes in the future. So, for example, those children are at greater risk for abuse and neglect. They're at greater risk over their lifetimes for chronic health conditions like diabetes and substance use disorders. They're higher at risk for suicide, poverty, teen pregnancy, and actually, in terms of crime prevention, they're at higher risk of being arrested, participating in criminal behavior, or being incarcerated in the future. And so taking a look at parents who are getting incarcerated is an important step to, you know, break cycles of poverty, of intergenerational trauma, of intergenerational incarceration, and, you know, try to shut down, you know, what I would call the trauma to prison pipeline.
So, Tom, anything else that you want to make sure that we address here while you have Lisa Menard on the line?
I guess I would just say that, you know, I'm not declaring medication-assisted treatment expansion a failure by any means. I am seeing some hopeful signs. But at the same time, I just want to emphasize that this is a life and death issue for people. And, you know, I've heard of two people who were recently released from incarceration and did die of an overdose. And, you know, I got 3 letters today from incarcerated people who, you know, sent me copies of their grievances and in one case even a lawsuit that they filed. They're working really hard to get access to this treatment, and for a lot of people it's not happening, and I think that we really need to have a sense of urgency about it.
That's Tom Dalton, Executive Director of Vermonters for Criminal Justice Reform. Tom, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you too, Lisa.
Thanks, Tom.
So let's talk about a few other issues while we have the time here, Commissioner Menard. And I'm going to bring up a question that actually came into our podcast, Brave Little State, from Rosie in Huntington, who wants to know, why are there so many incarcerated African Americans in Vermont? And Vermont, as most of the country, of course, does have a higher rate of African Americans in prison than the general population. And it seems like Vermont also may have a higher rate than many states.
That's accurate. Vermont has a disproportionate number of African Americans incarcerated. The why is that's not a question I can answer. I can say that there are certainly a number of groups looking at this. Vermont State Police has done significant work in looking at their arrest practices and making they have a lot of data about race. The UVM did some research regarding that. We're looking at our own practices once somebody is incarcerated around critical decision points and how those may look. I'm part of a racial disparity in the criminal justice panel right now, and these issues are being examined, and hopefully we'll see some changes in that disproportionate number.
Earlier in the program, we were talking about Vermonters who are serving time out of state and a problem with having enough beds in the general population to bring many of them back into state. At the beginning of this year, Phil Scott's administration proposed a new facility in Franklin County, and this would be, by Vermont standards, a very large facility, 925-bed prison and mental health facility in Franklin County. There would be 175 beds for women, 457 beds for men, some room for federal prisoners, also some room for people who are undergoing mental health treatment and have critical needs, and maybe some of this would be forensic patients as well. Where does that stand?
Right now, it really didn't go very far this past session. It was discussed, but I think, unfortunately, kind of the headline that went out about it was the tiniest of excerpts from the report that said that one possible way to finance it was a partnership, private-public partnership. So people took that as meaning it would be a for-profit, privately run prison, which is not the case.
But it would be operated by, is Corrections Corporation of America now called CoreCivic?
Correct.
So it would be operated by CoreCivic?
Absolutely not. Any facility in the state of Vermont would be operated by Vermont state employees, classified state employees. The line in the report was merely around financing the building of the building.
But it hasn't really moved forward much at this point.
It hasn't at this point, but I don't think the conversation has ended. I think Joint Justice Oversight is continuing to talk a little bit about it. I think it'll be an issue again this session. I think there's acknowledgement that something needs to be done at some point. A lot of people think, well, just cut your prison population in half and then you won't have that problem. And that that sounds great. For 1,700 people, it sounds potentially doable in the next decade. But it doesn't bear in mind that 7,000 people come through. So then if you cut your population in half, that doesn't cut in half the number of people that are entering and leaving.
It also doesn't address questions about how can Vermont address the healthcare needs of aging prisoners and prisoners who have different healthcare needs than they did a generation ago.
That's correct, as well as how do we address vocational needs? How do we have the space to deliver all of these services that we want and need to deliver in order to really return people much better prepared than when they came in?
Always plenty to talk about, certainly more to talk about the next time we have you on. Lisa Menard is Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.